impacting our community. More information is at kojoshow.org.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. In previous books, author Gary Wills has examined George Washington and the Enlightenment, President Lincoln and his Gettysburg Address, and what Jesus meant to the world. In his latest work, he explains why he believes the advent of the atomic bomb transformed the presidency, presidential power, and gave rise to a national security state. His new book is titled Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. Gary Wills joins me in the studio. We'll be taking your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us on Facebook and Twitter. How good to see you again.
It's good to be back.
Thank you very much. You talk in your book about how you believe the Manhattan Project was a violation of the Constitution and has changed presidential authority ever since.
Yes. In wartime, emergency powers are granted because of the emergency, and often illegal things are done. The Japanese Americans were interned. The habeas corpus was suspended under Lincoln. But usually when the war ends, there's a return to constitutional normality. The Supreme Court declared the suspension of habeas corpus unconstitutional, and did the same for the interning of the Japanese. But the Manhattan Project, although it was illegal throughout, it was an emergency, a succession of emergency powers, was never repented or forsworn. In fact, it was taken as a model for later activities. Why do I say it was illegal? Congress was lied to. It was outside the normal authorization process. All of the monies had not been assigned by Congress, as all federal funds are supposed to be. They were channeled through fake conduits. The physicists were paid by the universities and other projects that were underway for radar or bomb sites, etc. Money was siphoned off from those secretly. Senator Truman, when he was investigating the use of government money, never got onto the Manhattan Project, though they were spending billions in our current monies. They had 80 locales. They had three principal ones, each with thousands of people working. They had a total blackout on the people who were there. The physicists who came had to take assumed names. They had to disguise what they were talking about, even from their relatives. I have a friend who grew up at Los Alamos. She was a girl of 7 and 8 at the time, and she knew nothing about what her father was doing, and she said her mother knew nothing about it. They couldn't vote or have driver's licenses because they were there under assumed names. They spoke a kind of code. They never mentioned the bomb. They mentioned the gadget. They never used the word physicist. It was the most extraordinary. And then Leslie Groves had dictatorial power over them. He threatened that if people wanted to leave, he could draft them and send them to some remote army base. He sent out a person to assassinate Werner Heisenberg, thinking that he had atomic secrets that he could give to the Germans. He appointed his own successor. He figured, if I'm sick or have a heart attack or get poisoned or something. Nobody else has this project in his head, so I will have to train somebody to take over from me. Again, this was without any authorization in the normal things. He was outside the military chain of command. But the whole thing was, quotes, irregular.
But didn't it have the authorization of FDR?
Yes. He appointed a small group of people, Conant and others, to conduct this secret activity. They appointed Leslie Groves. They gave him a AAA priority and held off other people who were contesting for funds and places. They gave him resources of an extraordinary sort. For instance, he had his own private Air Force and secret Air Force bases where he trained pilots to deliver the bomb. He took planes right off the production line and reconfigured them to carry the bomb. He had a number of those, and he didn't tell the pilots what they were being trained for. He actually did practice raids on Japan with dummy bombs, the right size and weight, and dropped them to see how things worked. He was his own little government, and in fact, an aide to Dean Acheson, who was at the State Department as an underling at that point, went to look at the Manhattan Project right at the end of the war when it had been revealed what it was doing, and he came back and said, it's a police state.
Huh.
Nobody has had dictatorial power like Leslie Groves. Well, we were very proud of that. We were proud of the bomb. We were happy with it. And so it became something to boast about, not to repent. And the president took over many of the powers of Leslie Groves. Right at the end of the war, it was said, we now have to give the president power to initiate nuclear war with no consultation of Congress.
And yet the Constitution says something completely different.
Congress shall have the power to declare war. That was taken away from Congress in the case of nuclear war. The argument was, if there's a nuclear attack impending or occurring, there's no time to talk about it. Some one person, the president in this case, has to either anticipate or retaliate on his own hook. Now, that was an extraordinary power, never given before. And it didn't end there. For instance, when Truman went into the Korean War, Secretary of State Dean Acheson said to him, this is not a nuclear war, but in order to protect your power to initiate war at a moment's notice without anything coming from Congress, don't ask Congress for permission to go to war.
He told him not to.
Yes. And it would have been given. Congress would have given it in a shot. But he wanted to protect this new power of the president. And from that point on, there's never been a declared war since the Korean War by Congress. And the president has initiated war after war after war and secret war after secret war because keeping the nuclear secret was such an urgent necessity, they thought, that he had to, A, set up a great deal of secrecy, classification procedures, clearance procedures, loyalty tests, the NSA, the NSC, the CIA, agencies that would act in secret and spy on Americans and on foreigners to find out what they knew about the bomb and what Americans were saying about the bomb. He had to have a means of delivering the bomb, so the Strategic Air Command was created to keep planes in the air every hour of the day with a bomb aboard. And they had to have friendly bases to land at for refueling, for necessary repairs and that kind of thing. So we began this creation of a network of people who would be friendly. And if they were not friendly, we would knock them off and put in people who were friendly.
So you call this a quiet revolution in the power of the executive, a cult of the commander-in-chief.
Yes, the commander-in-chief, that's a fascinating thing. That had been a kind of dead clause in the Constitution. Nobody paid much attention to it because the commander-in-chief title is a British one, and it meant that when you had several different admirals at some part of the ocean, who might have had conflicting authority, the government would say, Admiral so-and-so will be commander-in-chief over the rest. And it was a temporary and geographically limited term. And that's the way it started in America. When Washington was sent up to Boston, General Washington, there were militia generals and other people who were who could have been competing authorities, and they said, you will be the commander-in-chief. Well, when the Constitution was drawn up, they said, in time of war, the president will be the commander-in-chief over all of the other commanders. And we kept the commander-in-chief title right up until Donald Rumsfeld's time, because we had CINCPAC, commander-in-chief of the Pacific, CINCUR, commander-in-chief of Europe, and a number of other commanders-in-chief. And he said, no, 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 we've got to stop using that title. We've got to keep it all for the president, the commander-in-chief. And so the Constitution says the president shall be the commander-in-chief of the military. And they meant the military at war because they didn't conceive of a standing army at that time during peacetime. Or, and of the militia when called into national service. So he's not even the commander-in-chief of the National Guard until it's called into national service. He's certainly not the commander-in-chief of civilians. And yet now he's regularly talked of that way. We are told we're electing our commander-in-chief. And when General Haig called Ruckelshaus at the Justice Department and told him to fire Archibald Cox as the independent counsel in the Watergate investigation. And Ruckelshaus said, no, that's not what Congress had in mind when they set up this independent counsel. And he said, Haig said, your commander-in-chief has given you an order. You must obey. Well, of course, Ruckelshaus is a civilian. He was not the commander-in-chief. When I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying, whatever else he is, constitutionally, the president is not my commander-in-chief, I got the most extraordinary mail saying, if he's not your commander-in-chief, you're not an American. Get out of this country.
Gary Wills, he's Pulitzer Prize-winning author of numerous books. His latest is titled Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State.
For the Beatles, it all came crashing down in 1969. They recorded one last classic album, Abbey Road, and by 1970, the band was no more. But what if that wasn't the Beatles' last trip to the recording studio? We're joined by a team of authors who've spent their careers digging through the band's unreleased recordings. We'll try our best to piece together what might have been. Join us for The Beatles' One More Album, Thursday at 9 p.m. here on WAMU 88.5.
I'm Jane Hall, host of the American Forum, inviting you to join me Tuesday night at 7 for a live broadcast of the American Forum on the climate change generation. We'll be talking about youth, media, and politics in an unsustainable world. My guests include Matt Nisbett from American University School of Communication, Juliet Alperin, environmental reporter for The Washington Post, and Kate Shepard, environmental reporter for Mother Jones. For more information, go to WAMU.org.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Welcome back. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gary Wills. His new book titled Bomb Power. Here's an email from Carl. He said, did General Groves make the decision to drop the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki with Truman being told after the fact?
No, Truman didn't know about the bomb when he was vice president. He wasn't told until he became president.
Until but 11 then, days later.
Yeah, that's right. But he did authorize. They had to take the decision to him, and he authorized the dropping of both bombs. It was going to be a package deal. The idea that we tried it out and we're going to wait and see what the Japanese thought of that, and then when they didn't respond instantly, we dropped the second one. It didn't work that way at all. They were always going to drop both of them. In fact, Oppenheimer recommended dropping them both on the same day so that there would be this tremendous demonstration of power. And he argued at that point, it will make sure that it'll never be used again. People will be so horrified. So we were going to shock not only the Japanese, but the whole world. And Groves said, no, you have to drop one first to make sure that it works, for one thing, and what the conditions are, so that if there's any problem, we can correct it for the second one.
Here's an email from Jerry in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He says, decades ago, one could argue the president must act quickly. Congress might not act quickly enough to deal with the war. But that's not true today. With immediate electronic communication, the president could at least consult with leaders of Congress, and then, once they've agreed, Congress should debate and then give a declaration of war. If a war is so nebulous, it cannot be argued, it shouldn't be fought.
Well, the objection to that that was raised is raised by the president and his forces is that Congress is not qualified to judge the matter because not everybody in Congress has clearance to the secrets. Remember, Lyndon Johnson said, if you knew what I know, you would see that I'm acting in a prudent and wise manner. But you can't know it because it's all classified. And that's the big secret now. That's the way of keeping the big secret. When the first President Bush did ask Congress to agree to go to the Kuwait war, not to declare war, but to agree. Cheney said you shouldn't even ask them that. Admiral Crow, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, went before the Intelligence Committee and said, I think we have not really given sanctions time enough to work. So give it some time, and then if you have to go to war, go to war. Well, right after that, Secretary of State James Baker went to the same committee and said, well, Admiral Crow no longer has clearance. He can't read the cables. So his advice is worthless. And, of course, if his advice is worthless, then so is yours, so is mine, so is everybody's, except those who are in this priesthood of the secrets. So keeping all of those secrets is a way of protecting the executive initiative. The secrets are no longer so much. The original justification for secrecy was so that the enemy would not know what you were up to. If you're going to invade, don't let them know when and where. But now it's not that. And the best illustration of that is my favorite Doonesbury strip. I asked Gary Trudeau for the original. It hangs on my wall. A person goes into Cambodia and sees this leveled rubble and a couple standing in front of their ruined house. And the person says, wow, this is an historic site. This is the site of the secret bombing of Cambodia. And the Cambodian man says, oh, no, it wasn't secret. I said to Martha, there are the bombs dropping on us. It wasn't to keep it secret from them. It was to keep it secret from the Senate so that they would not realize that he was conducting a war where we in a country that we were not at war with, and he was using funds that were given to conduct a Vietnam War, not a Cambodian war.
So what does all this say about the notion that in our democracy there are three co-equal branches of government?
Well, obviously one is equaler than the rest right now. And it's a kind of authority that we've never seen before World War II. The militarization of the president. He's not only the commander-in-chief, now they're even using the acronym SCOTUS, Supreme Commander of the United States. Can you imagine what the founders would have thought of that? John Adams was mocked for saying we should call the president Your Excellency. And now the president has been so militarized that when he gets off the plane now, he is saluted and he salutes back. That's a recent development. That's from Reagan's time. It's as if he were a military officer.
Exactly, as though he had served in the military.
Or that he had some kind of military standing. He doesn't. And that was proved in a court case. the estate of George Washington had some property in New York, Dutchess mm-hmm. County, and there was a tax break there for military people, and they said he should get that. And the court that decided the matter said, well, he did serve in the military before the Constitution came into effect, and he was paid by the Continental Congress and had a pension from the Continental Congress, that, which is not a continuing body under the Constitution. And as president, he's not a military figure. He doesn't get military pay. He doesn't get a military pension. He can't be court-martialed. The genius of the Constitution is civilian control. He's a civilian who's in charge of the military during war. But the idea that you should salute him and treat him as if he were a military person is totally against the spirit of the Constitution and against historic precedent.
There's also somehow this growing sense that we as Americans know less and less about how this country conducts its foreign policy. You talk about the lack of accountability as far as the role of assassins in our authorized form of war.
That's right. And you know, that has a parallel at the Manhattan Project, too. General Leslie Groves commissioned a man to go to Europe and assassinate Werner Heisenberg on the grounds that he might have atomic secrets. So almost everything that the CIA has done since then was first tried at the Manhattan Project. And to make that permanent, we didn't get out of the emergency at the end of World War II. We went into the Cold War, which is another state of emergency. We had greater, higher classification and loyalty and clearance procedures than during every part of the war except the Manhattan Project. And then we went from the Cold War into the War on Terror. We've had a continuing emergency. Senator Moynihan, in his book Secrecy, said, you would have expected classification of documents to slack off at the end of the Cold War. He said it didn't. It accelerated. It galloped, and it's still galloping.
What about the Pentagon Papers?
Well, that's what's interesting. Lyndon Johnson said, you don't know my secrets. Well, Daniel Ellsberg helped draw up the Pentagon Papers when McNamara wanted to find out what we actually knew about Vietnam. And so he realized that there weren't any great secrets in there, that the knowledge was very muddled and contradictory. And so that's why he leaked the papers. And the interesting thing is, Nixon was president at that time, and the Pentagon Papers covered only the Johnson administration and the Kennedy administration. So some people around Nixon said, well, let it go. Let him release. It won't affect you because it didn't investigate your conduct. And yet Nixon took the attitude, as most presidents do, I've got to protect this power of secrecy. I can't let it out because it'll diminish my control of this secret empire. Now, the use of secrecy is perfectly illustrated by a Supreme Court case, Reynolds versus U.S. An airplane, an Air Force plane, went down, crashed, and civilians doing electronic work on it, some perished, some survived. The ones who survived said there were a lot of irregularities on that plane, and we people weren't even told the right procedures for bailing out or where to go in case of an emergency. So the relatives of the people who perished sued the Air Force, and they said, show us your investigation of this accident, this crash. And it went to two courts, and the Air Force said, well, we can't release the investigation because state secrets are involved. The electronic work was something that has to be kept secret. And the judge in both cases said, well, show me the paper, the investigation, in camera, and if there's something that has to be withheld, I'll withhold it. And if the whole thing has to be withheld, I'll withhold it. And they said, no, we can't do that. State secrets. So it went to the Supreme Court, And by that time, the Korean War was going on. Vincent was the Chief Justice. And he said, it's a time of war. We can't destroy the morale of the Air Force. So I won't even ask to see the investigation in camera. All right. Then another 15 years or so goes by. And the investigation is declassified as part of a routine mass declassification. And the relatives get it and find out there were no state secrets in that case. But there was overwhelming evidence of criminal neglect. There had been fires in that plane. The plane was not kept up well. The pilot had shut down the wrong engine when he got in trouble. The emergency procedures had not been taught or followed.
So what you're saying is that secrets can be declared whenever it's useful.
Yeah, whenever it's useful to the government. Not only that, that case is still being used as a precedent. Whenever the government says you can't release state secrets because of Reynolds. Reynolds was retried under new grounds at the Rehnquist Court. And Theodore Olson and others advised the court, don't reverse this decision, because even if there were no state secrets, there was something maybe about procedures that would hint at where you could look for state secrets. They invented what they called the mosaic theory. If you have just one little pebble from a mosaic, you can reconstruct the whole mosaic from that one little pebble. So anything they want to declare a state secret, they can just declare it. And the court to this day observes that rule and lets the government say, don't go any farther here because state secrets are involved.
Gary Wills, his new book is titled Bomb Power, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. One other area I wanted to ask you about is President Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs. What was known by everybody who was not involved, or what we as the American people did not know?
Oh, well, Moynihan in his book Secrecy, a wonderful book that I draw on a lot, said the whole premise of the Bay of Pigs invasion was false, that you could put this little band of Cubans ashore and they would provoke a rebellion against Fidel Castro. He said every Cuban expert, every academic expert, every pollster who had been down there, every journalist who had been down there knew you were not going to knock off Fidel Castro at this moment of triumph after his revolution. He was too popular. But he said, why didn't Kennedy pay attention to any of them? Because their knowledge was unclassified. The people who went to him from the CIA and the military said, we know things that nobody else knows because we have our assets and our informers, and nobody can know these things except us. Therefore, you have to follow our advice and ignore everybody else's.
But you had Dean Rusk, then Secretary of State. You had Adlai Stevenson at the UN, neither of whom knew this invasion was going to take
place. That's right. And Stevenson was even told that we weren't involved and lied to the UN. He was so crushed when he realized that the Kennedys had lied to him. He went to Alastair Cook, a good friend of his. Cook writes about that in his own book. And he said, how could they do this to me? You know, I'll never be able to hold my head up again. And Cook said to him, well, don't worry. A lot of people have written valuable things when they have resigned in protest. And he said, oh, I can't resign. I'd lose all my influence.
Now, where that brings us is to the war in Iraq and the question of weapons of mass destruction.
Yes. Once the knowledge gets out into the press, it's easy to ignore it or refute it or silence it. And let me start with a parallel. Since everybody knew about the Bay of Pigs except Rusk and people like that, the New York Times got onto it. You know, it was all over Miami that this was coming. And they went to Kennedy and said, we know you're going to pull this off, and we think it's a bad idea, so we're going to publish this. And Kennedy said, no, you can't do that. That would be treacherous. That would be treason. You've got to keep the secret. And so they did. They regretted it later, and Schlesinger even said it was their duty to publish that, and it would have saved us from our terrible embarrassment. Well, as we know now, there was a lot of information out that that they did not have weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And that was so upsetting to Cheney that he had to quash it. He had to smear Valerie Plame. He had to smear other people and say, again, we know these secrets. And again, they had poor Colin Powell lie to the UN, just as Adlai Stevenson had lied to the UN. So anybody who tries to break into the sacred precincts of secrecy will be vilified, will be called unpatriotic, will be called outside the know. And we've seen that happen over and over and over.
Do you think Colin Powell knew he was lying to the UN?
No, I don't think so at all. They were lying to him. He tried to check what they told him, went over to the CIA himself and tried to. But the CIA was being pressured also by the president. So all these people, once they get aboard, are told you've got to stay aboard. And I think that's happening with Obama right now.
How so?
Well, there's a question why, when he said that he would get rid of extraordinary rendition and military tribunals and torture, why all of a sudden he's backed off? Why he's doing signing statements, for instance?
Gary Wills, his new book is titled Bomb Power.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This I believe.
My code of living is simple. One, never be cruel. Two, always be artistic. Three, never lose your sense of humor.
I'm Bob Edwards. Join me for the latest in our series of original This I Believe essays next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI, Public Radio International.
That's Bob Edwards coming up today at 2, right here on WAMU 88.5.
From Public Radio International, I'm Deborah Amos on the next America Abroad, The Carbon Conundrum. If you think negotiating a new climate treaty is tough, try preserving the rainforests of Peru.
This place that we're in right now, in the heart of the Madre de Dios, in another couple of years from now, you know, this all could be gone.
It's not easy going green.
Tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5.
If you travel by car, truck, boat, RV, or even private airplane, and you're considering cutting back your transportation costs, you can donate your vehicle to WAMU 88.5. By doing so, you're supporting the news, talk, and music programs you depend on. Call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org, and we'll take care of everything from picking up your vehicle to providing you the paperwork for your taxes. Thank you.
Be advised that Metro Bus and Metro Access will not operate today due to conditions of the area roads. Also, American University is closed. However, the campus library will be open today till 6 p.m. It's 23 degrees in Northwest Washington.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And welcome back. Gary Wills is with me. He's Pulitzer Prize-winning author of numerous books, including Lincoln at Gettysburg and Cincinnatus, George Washington and the Enlightenment. His new book is titled Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. Let's open the phones now. We'll go to Silver Lake, Ohio. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning. Mr. Wells, I've always been puzzled. In fact, you alluded a little bit to this when you referred to Admiral Crow saying, why don't we give it time to work? I'm puzzled about the decision to drop the second bomb on Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that it was done in haste, and the Japanese were given very little time to absorb what had happened in Hiroshima. Could you explain at all what was behind that decision to drop that second bomb so quickly? And I'll your answer off the air. Thanks very much.
All right.
Well, the decision to drop the bombs was to drop both. They always were going to use the two of them, and that's what the president authorized. They wanted to have an overwhelming demonstration of power. They didn't want to wait to get the reaction of the Japanese. They wanted to shock and awe, is to use a term that was later used, and to shock and awe the world. So the idea that they would wait around and see what the Japanese thought of it after the first one was not ever on the books.
Here's a message on email. It says, Mr. Wills, SCOTUS stands for Supreme Court of the United States in common usage. Please correct this flaw in your otherwise enlightening presentation.
That's absolutely right. The misunderstanding arose somewhere, and I repeated it, and I shouldn't have.
All right, and here's another email from Richard, who says, as a student of history, I find your guest statements about the war powers to be less than accurate in order to reach a conclusion before the fact. That appears more political than historic. In particular, Section 2 of Article 2 says, the president shall be the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. It does not state in war, as Mr. Will seems to imply, even with respect to the military. Regardless of how small the Army and Navy became in peacetime, they still existed. He was still the commander-in-chief.
But the people who drew up the Constitution did not think there would be a standing army in peacetime. And the troops that were kept up were kind of border patrol troops for Indian frontiers and that kind of thing. So it was understood that commander-in-chief, as it had always been used historically, meant in wartime.
All right, let's go to Keene, New Hampshire. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'm so glad to talk to Gary Wills. I have about 10 of his many, many books, from Jesus to Reagan. I'm just amazed at your energy. About this book that you have just written, I just retired being a history teacher at a little college in New Hampshire, Franklin Pierce College, and I have always been surprised by one thing. About 10 years ago, we had the late Howard Zinn, I say late with great regret, come up and give a talk called The CIA and the Future of Democracy. After it was over, the dean, who was something of a right-winger, just walked out and said, well, the usual crowd, blame America first. But he was trying to come up with a reasonable question, and he was asking the students to participate. It wasn't just his scholarship. And so I would ask you the question, is there any chance that the CIA, the way it is installed in the National Security Act of 1947, is there any chance at all that we will be able to have freedom of expression and that we will not have government secrecy accounting for everything in and around war if we did something about the National Security Act, which Truman said in his memoirs he just really was terribly unhappy about signing, but I never believed it.
Well, there have been attempts to rein in the CIA. The Church Committee was a famous investigation of assassination attempts by the CIA. But as time went by, the reforms that it advocated and initiated were ignored over and over. so that Senator Moynihan had to resign from the Intelligence Committee in protest when Casey of the CIA lied to him about mining harbors and that kind of thing. So its activities were always not only out of control, but concentrated on covert activity. And, you know, one of the worst people in this respect was President Eisenhower. With the Dulles brothers, one as Secretary of State and one as head of the CIA, he thought that it would be a very good idea if we kept our friendly bases and other things that were part of our empire to deploy the bomb and other armaments, if you would just knock off inconvenient rulers and put in puppets. So he had the CIA overthrow Mossadegh in Iran and return to the Shah of Iran. And, of course, that got us into a lot of trouble because we earn a lot of enemies in a country when we knock off their ruler and put in our own puppet, as we've done in case after case, did in Vietnam, did in Nicaragua. So he tried to initiate these secret coups. Mm-hmm. And the trouble with that is, in the Mossadegh case, Kim Roosevelt went out there and hired soldiers of fortune and troublemakers and thugs in the streets to riot. And whenever we do these operations, we acquire some unsavory people to act for us. And these become assets, they're called, and they hang around forever. Now, we're acquiring those at a tremendous rate right now. We have more contractors in Afghanistan and Iraq than we have soldiers. And what do you do with those people afterward? They know all kinds of secrets that you don't want out. They're not people who are going to just disappear into peaceful oblivion. Remember, the Watergate break-in was done by Cubans who were left over from the Bay of Pigs invasion. Once these assets are there, you start using them. And when you have a secret empire like this, your hands are tied by a lot of your associations. One example of that is Diego Garcia. When some of our puppets were overthrown back in the 60s, some people decided, well, let's go somewhere where there aren't any indigenous people to resent us. And so they went to this island in the Indian Ocean, and they threw out the inhabitants, just kicked them out, confiscated their property, shot their livestock. It was a British protectorate, and they made a secret agreement with Britain, not a treaty that Congress could ratify. And they had secret funds to build the tremendous installations there. It is a nuclear and conventional harbor and airport and a very key place for our activities in the Middle East. No journalist is allowed there. It's total secret. This is what I mean by the Manhattan Project spinning off little Manhattan projects all around the world. And when a president comes in, like Obama, people come to him from the CIA and other intelligence agencies and other activities of the government, and they say, don't tear down this stuff that we've built. Took a long time. You may need it down the road. Don't destroy the morale of our people. They might become rebellious. They might start blabbing. And so, naturally, a president who probably didn't know a lot of this is going to be intimidated by this. And they'll start doing what Obama is doing. So Panetta, when he was confirmed to the CIA, said, well, we'll have to consider rendition. There might be a use for that somewhere down the road. And we've got to keep military tribunals. We might try some people in civilian court. But
though previously the candidate Obama had come out against such
things.
That's
right.
Now,
he also came out against signing statement and started doing it. He came out against torture, but he said, we're not going to investigate torture and we're not going to release photographs. In fact, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told the British they couldn't release torture photographs.
Here's an email from David in Benton, Kentucky, regarding the president having unlimited war-making powers. What was the Tonkin Gulf all about? What about congressional approval of the war on terror? Do those not count because there turned out to be flaws in the claims the president brought before Congress? As for the Manhattan Project, those of us who appreciate the effort can only ponder how critics can disregard the consequences if we had not built a bomb and Hitler had successfully done so. As for the secrecy of the projects, how could it have been accomplished otherwise? And we should say that that was part of the raison d'etre for constructing the atomic bomb, was that Albert Schweitzer and others thought that Hitler was going to get it first.
Well, there's no reason to challenge any of that, that in a wartime you do have extraordinary emergency powers. But normally you revert to the Constitution afterward. My point is that we did not do that, that the practices of the Manhattan Project were indurated, were sent out into peacetime, so-called peacetime, and distorted the Constitution in a permanent way, not just in a temporary wartime way. Now, as for congressional approval of war, that's not a declaration of war, and a president often will lie to get the president, the congressional.
So you're saying approval is very different from declaration.
Not only that, remember what the Congress did in the War Powers Act. It said, presidents are starting war on their own now. We want to get back into the act at least a little bit. So instead of claiming their constitutional right to declare war, they said, well, we'll make a partnership with the president. The president will have to come and tell us when he's going to war, and we'll give him a certain period beforehand, established period, to come back and get our permission to continue the war. Now, the first part of that, informing Congress that he's going to war, has occurred in Iraq and other places. The second part has never occurred. The War Powers Act has never once been observed.
Gary Wills, his new book is titled Bomb Power, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now to Panama City, Florida. Good morning, Glenn.
Yes, good morning, Diane, and thank you, Mr. Wills. My question basically is, actually my first question was going to be, how would you get, or what would be the most effective way for citizens to stop this juggernaut of secrecy and elitism and this plutocracy? But I think that the first step would be, how would you suggest in a soundbite that we, how would you change minds of people that just don't want to get their minds around or their around the fact that these things are taking place? What would your suggestion be, sir?
Well, one of the problems, of course, is that the Congress has been supine. The Congress is easily intimidated by war power. For one thing, if a president commits troops, it's considered unpatriotic for the Congress to cut off the funds. And so they've never done it. Many people, war protesters, myself among them, tried to get Congress to cut off funds for Vietnam for an undeclared war. And, of course, anybody who did that was considered deserting the boys, or now the deserting the girls and boys, you have to support our troops. So once the president starts something like that, it's extremely hard to stop it. But aside from that, the Congress has not asserted its legitimate authority, its oversight authority over many things, and it has allowed the president, especially under from Reagan on, to assert the unitary executive, as it's called, that if the president has any activity, he has to control the whole of that activity. It started under Reagan and the Meese Justice Department, in which Congress said, we've set up regulatory agencies, and you're now deregulating them without our authority. We have oversight over the places that we've set up, and we have to have it because, obviously, we can impeach anybody in the executive, and we can't impeach unless we can investigate and find out what's going on. Well, the unitary executive theory that was supported by the Meese Justice Department and adopted by the Federalist Society and then adopted by Cheney and Addington in the Bush administration is that, no, once you put the president in charge, he's in total charge. The executive is a unit, and you can't be split up and divided up. But, of course, splitting up and dividing up our government is the constitutional system, but not under the modern view of the presidency. So it's up to Congress to challenge that, and they've challenged it so little that most Americans don't even know what the unitary executive is. And the people who could challenge that have not been very willing. Now, you ask, what can a citizen do? I think try to bring pressure on your congressional member or your senator to challenge these things. Unless they're challenged, they'll just continue to grow in secret, like mushrooms in the dark, and we will never get out of this.
And, of course, the broadening of the role of secrecy in our government just seems endless. More and more things declared secret.
Yes, and of course, all that classification that goes on, it will never be declassified. Declassifying is extremely complicated and expensive and long-term. As any of you who have got your FBI files knows, they're all crossed off and everything. Lawyers work on them at great length, and considering privacy and government secrets and all that. So even when they get declassified, most of the knowledge is still hidden.
Gary Wills, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His new book is titled Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. Thank you so much, Mr. Wills. I look forward to seeing you again.
It was great.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company.